We all have our stories, and there are definitely variations on the theme of simply being human. And truly, we have more similarities than differences. We are born into a dangerous world, and we are left in the care of others for a good portion of our lives. We have to survive and compete and make our way with other people and in society, and much of the time, money is involved. Hi, I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. Today, we feature the short story and writers who elegantly express our human condition through them. Karen E. Bender, the critically acclaimed author of A Town of Empty Rooms and Like Normal People, has just released a collection of short fiction entitled Reunion. I'll talk with Karen in just a minute. Dan Koshner is one of the most well-respected authors in the Bay Area, and he joins us a little later in the broadcast. Today, we'll also explore the work of another storyteller through the just-released album Wanted, The Songs of Paul Handel, featuring Paul's brother Carl Handel, backed up on steel guitar by the always amazing Eddie Meisy. But right now, I'd like to bring you my conversation with Karen E. Bender. Refund, just released from Counterpoint Press, is a collection of stories that are poignant, funny, tragic, and the stories are real and honest, and the writing doesn't get in the way. Bender currently lives in Wilmington, North Carolina, and I spoke with her on the telephone a couple of days ago. Karen E. Bender, welcome. So glad to be talking to you. Thanks for making the time.
Oh, I'm thrilled. Thank you for having me.
We're here to talk about your book of short stories, Refund, but some of our listeners might not be familiar with your other work. So maybe give us a brief heads up on those books and maybe let us know, as a writer, the difference. What does the short story form offer you that that a novel does not?
Well, all of my work actually starts from something I want to figure out or explore in myself, some feeling. For example, my first book, Like Normal People, had to do with the feeling or the yearning to figure out how to grow up. I was just started kind of in my mid-20s, and I didn't know kind of what the next step was, and I wondered how did people create a family, you know, how did you become a mother, or, you know, all these different things. And so that book was an effort to kind of grapple with that question. And that's a book that was from two points of view. The hub of the novel was a mentally challenged woman in her 40s, Lena Rose. And the book was from two points of view. One was her 14-year-old daughter, a niece, Shelley, and one is her mother, Ella. And it was kind of about how each of them are trying to grow up in different points in their life. And that really kind of helped me figure out different things inhabiting the different characters. And my second book, A Town of Empty Rooms, was trying to deal with the idea of communication and I in different venues of the kind of life, like in a synagogue, in a community, in a family. You know, how do people talk across each other? It was just something I was seeing a lot of kind of in the world and in people, and I wanted to explore that. So that was something that I looked in that book. And this book, interestingly, you know, all my novels actually started as short stories. I was always kind of dragged kind of against my will into it becoming a novel because I just love the short story form the most. It's the form I feel most comfortable with. I love, you know, all the ways you can play with it, and I feel my subconscious kind of forms itself most happily in the short story form, you know, the dream, the moment that changes things for a character. So all along, I've been writing stories. One of the stories in Refund, Chick for My Dream Life, I actually wrote when I was a student at Iowa. It was the first story I'd ever revised over and over, and it was the first one I turned into workshop. And so that it's kind of very gratifying to have that in the book. And then the other ones evolved over basically the last 10 years. I had been writing them after Like Normal People, and then I stopped and wrote A Town of Empty Rooms kind of in between, and then I finished the collection after that came out. And I think that I wanted to deal with issues of money and worth, and I didn't kind of try to pick that as a theme originally, kind of, it just kind of evolved. I think one way it happened is I was doing an NEA, I got an NEA grant in 2002, and they asked, what are you working on now? You know, which is the worst question for a writer. And I wrote, and I looked actually recently at my NEA project description, and eerily, it's kind of what is on my book jacket, because it was like, oh, I want to write about money and how it affects people and issues of worth. And so that was clearly in my mind as early as 2002 as something I want to explore in my stories, and I think kind of revealed itself in different ways. But it wasn't really conscious as I wrote them throughout the years.
So you've been writing these stories over the course of many years. And that is a thread that runs through them, the whole idea of worth, money as something that validates something also, though, that we need. We need to pay the rent. We need to put our kids through school. And sometimes getting money is what we need to do. And it does run through the stories in different ways. And I think I'll bring up the one of the short stories in the book that is called Anything for Money.
Uh-huh.
That, and it, you which is also the name, I think that is the name of the show that the producer develops, where people do essentially anything for money, but it seems to then be running through some of the other stories as well. I mean, just even that show. But so tell us a little bit about that story.
You know, that story, it's interesting. That story actually began as an assignment. It was through Zoetrope magazine, which is a wonderful magazine, and they were giving out assignments at that point. I guess it was a kind of early 2000s. And Adrian Brodeur, who was the editor, said, you know, do you want to do a story? And here's the idea. And an idea was from Francis Coppola, who is the kind of head person behind Zoetrope. And the idea was, it was pretty vague, but it was kind of something like a grandfather, you know, is very successful and has some sort of nice friendship with his granddaughter, and then something happens where he can't save her, he can't help her in some way. It was something like that. And so I looked at that and I thought, oh, this will be fun. And I'd never written with an assignment before. And I know reality shows or Survivor, I think, was new then. And I was just really interested in them and why people went on them and what they, you know, what they got from it. And so I thought, what would it be like to be this producer of one of those shows? And he was just such a fun character to inhabit because he was so different for me in different ways. And he just, you know, was so confused. And those are the best characters to work with, I think.
And what I noticed running through the stories was an emotional longing and longing for security. And that security in our lives is often symbolized by financial security. And so there was this mixture of that, emotional security being defined by this financial security. And that certainly was the case in that story, that he ultimately could not buy what he needed.
Right. Money is actually a metaphor in all the stories in different ways for, you know, connection or power or, you know, a lot of different other issues that it's supposed to take the place of. Yeah, that's a good point.
And most of your stories involve families and the dynamic between parents and children and the lingering effects that we have upon one another across generations. Or that's something that I saw threaded through these stories, where that longing for security passes through generations, and also that sometimes we love our children, but we maybe don't want to be around them right now or something. And so I see a lot of those real challenges that we sometimes don't even speak about in our lives, right, expressed in your stories.
Well, you know, one thing about writing about family is I know when I started writing, there was a writer I really loved named Helen Simpson, who's a British writer who writes a lot about raising small kids and is really funny and really dark about it. And I feel like my stories are supposed to be kind of the antidote to, say, the holiday letter, you know, that people send out where they say everything's so wonderful and we went here and everyone's doing so well. And it basically, the response that one has to those letters is sometimes, you know, oh, I'm happy for them. And sometimes it's kind of like, I feel kind of bad, you know. And I think they're, because they're not exactly about connecting. They're about, you know, kind of showing off sometimes. And I think what I want my stories to be about is the feelings people have that they don't want to talk about, that they feel maybe embarrassed about, and that actually, you know, if you express them and you express, you know, all the different feelings people have in a family from, you know, all different things, that it's healing. And, you know, I have my family is all a lot of therapists. And I feel like that in a way, writing for me, it's an absolute form of therapy. And it's a way of trying to connect with readers in this kind of sacred bond of honesty. So that's kind of my thought on that.
Well, one of your stories, really, I found myself, maybe you were performing therapy on me, because I did find myself really weeping at the end of it because I was identifying so much with it. And that story was the loan officer's visit.
Right.
And this is a story where the daughter goes away to college, she moves away, has her life, and never quite has a bead on her parents, on her father. Well, I don't want to give too much of that story away, but can you talk a little bit about that and the desire? It seemed to me a desire to have the child as an adult with her own children, was still just wanting the approval and the love of her parents. And it was something they couldn't give her in the form she wanted.
You know, how do people connect? I think people connect in so many ways, and every human is so different. You know, we all are just in such different bodies and have such different demands and longings. It can be hard to connect in the way that one wants, you know, and I think that story is also about the feeling of being sort of far away from your own family. And, you know, and it's so common, such a common experience. And, you know, we live in North Carolina, and my family, my parents live in Los Angeles. And it's really far. And so I think there's a sorrow in that you're far away. So I think I was trying to explore that feeling, you know, how do you connect over time and space, and you know, how can you find a common ground with your parents in different ways?
You put it, many of us, including myself,
left
home early and have lived our lives, and then it becomes harder to maintain those early bonds. And I do find a little bit of depression lurking in these stories, because I think many people walk around being depressed a lot of the time, or at least what I was perceiving in the story. I think it was a chick from my dream life where I think the father is suffering something and not a big character in the story, but a very, to me, loomed large in that story as well as the relationship of the sisters. Well, why don't you tell us about that story?
You know, that story is a really important story for me because I started that story after actually a very hard workshop I had in New York with a very charismatic teacher who essentially wanted everyone to write in a certain way, and I wasn't really writing in that way. And so I stopped taking the workshop, and then I thought, I didn't write for 3 months, which I'd never done. I always had written. And I thought, I really want to write something for myself. And so then the line came to me is the first line. I liked helping my sister hide her bad hand in the morning. And it just is such a weird line. I thought, where is this going? And I really wanted to write about sisters. I have two sisters. And I just thought I really wanted to just write about that dynamic. And I wanted to write about Los Angeles and, you know, kind of these girls kind of vulnerable and free on the beach. And so it just evolved from that. I just love that story. It was a lot of fun to write.
And it was fun to read, too. It was fun to read. Your topics are also contemporary, and you deal with some things in the stories that are challenging just even to think about. The opening story of the book is a story called Reunion that has a shooting in it.
Right.
But I felt that some of the other elements of the relationships were what that story was really talking about, but that there was a shooting within the first few minutes of the reunion.
Right, right.
And so to bring that kind of thing into a short story, why do you use a device like that?
So interesting. I mean, that story, you know, that story is an interesting one. I mean, I feel like there are a couple of shootings in the book, and I do feel like somehow that's part of the American psyche right now, that it's just something that people think about, you know, and are worried about. And it's just something that came up, you know, and you kind of can't control, I think, why something comes up in a story. It just does. In that story, that story is really about time. And, you know, reunions are really about, high school reunions are such an interesting American ritual where it's a way we mark time every 10 years with these people we have this deep bond with, you know, that we grew up with. So I had been to actually a couple of my reunions. And so I think what I wanted to write about is they are about time and they're about mortality, and having this shooting suddenly brought that even more to the forefront. You know, it was like, what, you know, what is this, you know, this is suddenly about how much time do we have and what, how, you know, how long are we going to be here? And then she has this, you know, longing for this old boyfriend. And I think that's really about, you know, how nostalgia can kind of fool us as we're in life and dealing with mortality. That was what I wanted to explore in that story.
And that he happens to, in her perception, save her.
Right. And right.
Yeah. That, well, and I don't want to give too much of that story away because I thought I liked the way that story kind of moved along. And many of your stories, and tell me if this is something that is more stylistic for you or what you embrace in the short story, but they're slice of life kind of stories that have some character definition, but really sometimes we are left hanging in a way of,
yeah, yeah.
Well, what happens next? But it's almost like what happens next is not necessarily the point.
Yeah, I know. That's, you know, it's a criticism I've seen a couple times of the stories, that the endings are not, don't offer closure. And you know, I kind of thought, well, isn't that kind of the point? I mean, I tell my students, because, you know, stories are an artificial way of you know exploring life. You know, you're putting into this form of a story. You know, but I feel like life kind of balances in this, you know, in this sort of place of hope and despair, kind of. You know, that essentially you want your story to end on a place of that. That's my thought about an end of a story, which I think then doesn't offer closure. And I think that can be hard because I think we're taught, like via movies and TV and stuff, that we should, you know, imagine a certain closure. But I don't think that's realistic.
Well, I don't think it's realistic either. And I think sometimes in fiction, the closure we're presented with sometimes isn't the closure we as the reader might have imagined. And so in some ways, I think this, many of your stories throw it back to the reader in a way to be thoughtful or to stay with those characters for maybe just a bit longer.
I think it's interesting. Yeah. I mean, my goal with every story is to have the reader think, I'm not alone. Someone else feels this way too. I feel like that's the greatest thing a piece of writing can do. And that's, you know, where I can read a story, you know, across time, across experience, across all different issues, you know, that a person has, and just feel that with the writer, I just think is the most amazing thing about a story.
The title story of the book, Refund, mm-hmm. is set in, well, the time of 9/11, and it's set in New York City.
Right.
Did you feel a desire to kind of deal with that sort of displacement and the lingering effects of it?
Yeah, I mean, that story is based, you know, a little bit on our own experience in New York around 9/11. We actually lived not far from Ground Zero. We lived, you know, nearby, and that was really a way of trying to cope with the horror that was around, you know, like, you know, just living in the area. There was no way to sort of deal with it besides just trying to write feelings about it and find a way to cope with it that way. So in a way, it's trying to deal with that whole experience.
Well, I thought it added a dimension for those of us who experienced it from afar and through the media, that it really, it had me thinking about it differently on a much more personal level.
Mm.
And I actually found that story, I liked the relationship between the two women.
Oh, interesting.
In some ways, I felt that they were that the communication between them was building a whole new relationship, or that's the way I perceived it. And again, we're being kind of vague here because they are short stories, and we don't want to give too much away. But but each one of them, I feel, had something great to offer. You deal with another contemporary topic as well in one of the stories called The Sea Turtle Hospital, which deals, well, does it deal with school shooting or does it have a school shooting in it? And what really struck me was that they were so prepared and knew how to corral. They all had their roles of what they needed to do.
Right.
And I fear that that's a very real thing in schools.
Yeah, it's true. Well, I think schools do have whole protocols to deal with this. Yeah, it's really true.
Anything you want to say about the setting of that story?
I mean, that story is a little bit based on a school our kids went to, which is a magnet school, and had many lockdowns, and or some lockdowns. I just remember once we were standing out, all the parents were standing outside for pickup, and there was apparently a lockdown going on, you know, and some parent texted a teacher inside and said, are you guys all huddled in a corner? And the teacher texted back, yes. And it just, so heartbreaking, you know, that this is a school, you know, they should not be huddled in the corner waiting for whatever is going to happen. They should be learning, you know, so it just was such a sad situation. It was one of those things that, again, I felt like I had to grapple with it in fiction. You know, when things feel overwhelming in the world, I think that's when fiction or writing about it can just be a way of trying to deal with the chaos of it. So I think that was the sort of impetus for that story.
And before we move on, I just want to also bring up another one of the stories in this volume. And I'm talking with Karen E. Bender on her just released book, Refund.
Mm-hmm.
And the name of the story is For What Purpose? And it deals with the main character is a TSA worker or security worker in an airport. And I just felt that story was so moving in that she just wants to keep people safe.
Yes, that story evolved when I was flying around, actually for my last book, a fair amount. And I was going through airports and looking through at the TSA people. And I thought, you know, they're trying to protect people from, you know, danger. But what if they're trying to protect people from their own feelings in a way? Like what can they be a metaphor for? They seem like this beautiful metaphor, the TSA people. So So that's where that started. And then it's about, you know, about longing and, you know, and just, I think that was, that story in Reunion really came from my subconscious in a way that felt really right and interesting to me. I mean, sometimes you're not sure where a story comes from, and so they come from some deep, interesting place. So, yeah.
Well, it seems like you come from a family of writers, or you live in a family of writers.
Let's see. Well, I'm married to a writer. My husband, Robert Anthony Siegel, is also a fiction writer and a wonderful writer. And my sister, Amy's an amazing short story and novelist writer. Yeah, I mean, it's a nice community to be able to, you know, gossip with them and help, and, you know, we speak the same language, which is good.
It must be hard, too.
You know, it's interesting when you have, you know, you're doing the same field, it's kind of a Rorschach test for people and their thoughts. You know, people can say, oh, it's really hard having a sister who's a writer or having a husband who's a writer. And so, I mean, I think every relationship has its complications, but I think it can sort of reveal something a little bit about the person asking.
And those complications are much of what thread through your stories here. And congratulations on its publication. It's released by Counterpoint Press.
Yeah.
Karen, thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'm Suzanne Lang, and we've just listened to my conversation with Karen E. Bender. And her latest book by Counterpoint Press is Reunion. Right now, let's take a musical break and listen to Your Love, a song written by the late Paul Handel, who died in 2008. His brother Carl pays tribute to him by performing his songs. This from the liner notes of Wanted, the songs of Paul Handel. Paul was a complex man and wrote about life and its many aspects. His stories are filled with heartache and humor and touch parts of life that most songwriters don't touch. So please enjoy and stay tuned for my conversation with Dan Koshner on his volume of short stories, Occupy and Other Love Stories.
You tell me that I make you happy. You say you're sad when you're alone. When I call you on the phone, you say you love me. Why don't you love me when I'm home? Your love is strong at Christmas time. Shows up again on Valentine's Day. If true love's supposed to be forever, why can't I have your love today? You tell me I'm all you ever wanted. You say I'm all you ever need. When I'm gone, you really seem to miss me. When I'm home, I feel like I should leave. Your love is strong at Christmas time. Shows up again on Valentine's Day. If true love's supposed to be forever, why can't I have your love today? You tell me I'm all you ever wanted. You flatter me, you play with my heart. You promise your love as I hold you. and promises is all I ever got. Pretending things are different, I guess I'll always be the fool. It really doesn't matter how you treat me, I'll love you no matter what you do. Your love is strong at Christmas time, shows up again on Valentine's Day. If true love's supposed to be forever, why can't I have your love today? Why can't I have your love today?
That was Carl Hendel and Eddie Meissy, and you could pick up their album, Wanted, The Songs of Paul Hendel, at the Last Record Store in Santa Rosa. I'm Suzanne Lang, and you're listening to KRCB's A Novel Idea. Dan Koshner is one of the most well-regarded authors in the Bay Area, nearly as much for his ability to teach and encourage other writers as for his astute observations on family, culture, and self. Here's my conversation with Dan about his lovely book, Occupy and Other Love Stories, published by Bart Schneider and Kelly's Cove Press. I began our talk by reading from one of his stories from his earlier collection, Jobs and Other Preoccupations.
It wasn't very good, really, but she took some risks. One way of seeing stories is as a succession of problems to be solved. The storyteller creates a problem, then solves it or doesn't solve it. Some problems are more interesting than others. And when I read that, I thought, oh, I wonder if this is you speaking to us about the way you yourself look at your own work.
I think so. I start many things, and probably only a small fraction of them do I finish. And it is often that there's a problem at the center of the story, and if it becomes really challenging enough or interesting enough for me to go on with it, not that I make a conscious choice exactly, it sort of stays with me or it doesn't. But yeah, if the problem somehow transcends an individual's circumstance in life and becomes something a little bit broader, has more social importance, then I feel drawn into it more.
In some ways, I look at your work as not necessarily telling a story, but telling the story in a way of a person or a couple, a situation, a slice that seems to crystallize or reflect upon sometimes difficult issues, but the difficult issues of daily living. The way a parent even reflects upon their own life in context to their children. There was a story. It had to do with hitchhiking.
Oh yes, okay, sure. That's in the recent book, Occupy and Other Love Stories, and it's called Off the Road. Yeah, the dad in that story, I think I identify with him pretty closely. Is struggling to give a message to his daughter, his teenage daughter, and she's made it very clear that she doesn't want to be taught things by her parents. And that's real in my life. And so he has to find some authentic place to come from, and it's reflecting on his own experience, which was hard.
And so you're drawn to this juxtaposition of the social, the political, and the very, very personal at the same time, instead of, say, fantasy. So to talk a little bit about what drives you as a writer.
I'm not a big fan of fantasy. I don't read a lot of it. I tend toward short stories because I have a short attention span. I like Rick Moody. George Saunders, Grace Paley, Frank O'Connor from way back. And those are stories that are, I think, are psychologically challenging and ask us to think about our values in different ways. And so stories like that that draw us in and make us wonder how we are in the world and what our choices mean, I think, are at first entertaining to me, but also leave me with something, often a sense of deeper connection to people. One of the odd things about stories, when you get into the very particular nature of characters in their lives, is that the more particular they are, sometimes the deeper the feeling of connection that we know each other. Those nuanced experiences that we are familiar with, but we don't often see written or spoken. We don't see them on television. So that's what I'm drawn to in reading and hopefully in my writing.
We're talking today after a rather horrific shooting event, and again, I think of one of your stories that the father and son interacting, and it was more looking at the war, but it was talking about the child asking, is everyone, bad things happening to bad people? And I wonder if you had any reactions, immediate reactions. I mean, you have children and kind of the explaining of that.
Yeah, it's hard not to have a little sense of terror around that. My son's in elementary school, my daughter's in high school, and I think it could happen anywhere at any time in this country. I mean, why not? You know, curiously, in another story revolving around my son, he's very interested in guns. And we struggle with that. We don't want to deny him his passion, and he watches videos about constructing weapons and things like that. But that's where his fascination is now. He's 11. He hasn't done any harm in the world. I don't want to scare anyone, but that's his interest, and it's a challenge for both his mother and I to know how to deal with that.
Hard lessons that we're presented with every day.
Certainly, yeah.
Why don't we give the readers and our listeners a flavor of your writing so they'll have a little bit of an understanding of what we're talking about here. And I understand you've brought a story that is not in either one of these collections.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I could start with that. One of the things I'll just, as preface, say, part of the joy of writing short stories is that you can try on really unusual forms, and probably 50% or more of the time they don't work. But sometimes they do, you know, and maybe this one, it felt okay to me when I was done with it. It's called Hixley.Elizabeth@Hotmail.com. Based on your blockbuster rentals of November, December 2010, it's apparent you enjoyed George Clooney flicks, 9, and nearly as plain you had some kind of a thing for George Clooney. But there's been a spike since the new year in Fassbinder films, notably the 1969 classic Love is Colder Than Death, and 6 others in 10 days. We don't know how to account for the change. Clooney, we decided, resembles your boyfriend, your former boyfriend, his chin and eyes, and your father, lips and nose, based upon your photos on Bing. And we noted an 83% decrease in the number of emails from you to your parents shortly after Christmas. Your bank activity did not change over the last quarter, excepting the predictable rise preceding the holidays. But with the turn of 2011, or shortly before, we counted 8 transactions at the site number CAD0519, 174.6 miles from your nearest and most frequently visited automatic teller machine. Our records show 9 withdrawals from non-B of A ATMs, incurring fees of $113.50 since the new decade began. Coincident with the flurry of withdrawals, $763.50 including fees, we noticed a marked decrease in Costco purchases, particularly low-sodium Triscuits and low-fat Lucerne brand vanilla yogurt in the 12-pack 8-ounce containers, and a marked increase in Martini and Rossi sweet vermouth from 0 to 2 1.5-liter bottles, and over the same period, December 30th through January 11th, another new preference, Haagen-Dazs ice cream bars, coffee almond crunch, 3 6-packs in 12 days. Do you still buy toilet tissue? Have you stopped feeding your cats? Your library fees exceed $50, and your last attempt to borrow, Every Man's Guide to Unsafe Mycelium, was denied. Lucky for you, we say, but you bought a Mossberg 12-gauge pump-action short-barrel shotgun for $279.99, and we see you were billed full cost for a visit to Dr. Simon Lipschitz in mid-December, and we're quite sure you didn't go, given at the time of your appointment you purchased $36.19 worth of regular unleaded and a bag of spicy corn nuts 65 miles south of his office. We're not contacting you now in this case to offer liposuction, Demerol, Cymbalta, or a weekend in the Bahamas, though on all of the above we can guarantee a 20-30% savings until the end of January, and fantastic low rates of up to 50% on Wolfschmidt vodka and the highest quality HP and FMJ ammo. We write because we see you running headlong toward your own undoing, i.e. disaster, what is sometimes called immeasurable sorrow. This is not a cave. This, what you're in, dark as it seems, is only a tunnel. Your desires chart a course, and we know, with a 3% margin of error, where you're going. You might or might not ever love again, Beth. There's a limit to what our instruments can do. We think perhaps regret is a bottomless vessel, but of this we are sure. There is no end of wanting.
Dan Koshner reading a news story for us.
I wanted to read that one in part because we watch Netflix at home, streaming, and they've categorized us. A dysfunctional family drama is what pops up first. So that's what we seem to like. Although my daughter is on the same account. She likes vampire miniseries, and my wife likes English mysteries. So it's a dysfunctional family that seems to have won the day there.
It is amazing how we are characterized by computers or by analytical programs that value our choices, our bank withdrawals, right, our purchases. And I sometimes get so resentful of that, you know. I was just browsing, really.
Yeah.
You know? So, but I think that story is very in the moment of where we are culturally, and that's how your stories really do strike me as being very in the moment. But that interests you.
I think over the last decade or so, with what's happened, we went to a war that was very unpopular. We saw our country do things that were really demoralizing. People still have to live with that in some way and still raise their families and have to think about their values, and they still go shopping and still have to often buy from companies that they fundamentally disagree with politically. So how do we cope with that? How do we live in that world? Those are things I think about, and somehow they manifest in the stories, I think.
Writing short stories in particular seems to me that it would be quite the challenge to have the kind of language choices to get something into 12 pages versus 212 pages. And so what's your process? Do you do a lot of revision?
I wouldn't recommend this process to anyone. But I tend to write up to a certain point and put it down and then read back to where I left off and start over. So I have to hear it as if I'm playing music almost to get back to where I was. And so when I try to write something long, it gets really difficult. I get to a point where I can't read it anymore or see it anymore. I'm in the midst of that now. I'm trying something longer. But I don't really have a first draft and a second draft. It's always in a process of revision, even when it's coming out.
Do you have more than one story going on at a time?
Generally not. I'm often reading other things, but I usually try to focus on one story at a time.
What I also notice about your writing, that it's not what I would call clever or gimmicky, or your language really does foreground the story. And I know that you teach writers, too. So how do you work with other writers and yourself with dealing with language that you want to tell a story but not get in the way of a story, especially in the short story format?
I think you just said it very well. You know, I think you don't want the language to get in the way. Often the language in the story is the language of a character or the character's thoughts. And so it ought to give some sense of what happens inside that person. The way they process their feelings and the information, and so it has to come from there. I think for me, for it to work.
I picked up your first book of short stories, Jobs and Other Preoccupations, and I immediately committed to sending it to a friend of mine who works in a state hospital.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I thought he might enjoy it. That seems an unusual setting, but it does really crack open working with people in a mental health setting.
Yeah. A little more so probably in the first book than in the second, although there is one certainly that happens in that frame too. That's been my background outside of writing and teaching writing. I've worked in mental health in some form or other for quite a few years. And probably my best experience with that was in New York City. And there was really some very thoughtful, philosophical leadership in the program. And I learned a lot from just case meetings, doing counseling, and talking about people's lives. I think we took a real unusual kind of existential approach. I remember cases, a man who was chastised at his group home because he shaved and left little filings of hair in the sink, and they were putting restrictions on his freedom. He was an adult, and because he failed to clean the sink after, and he'd been told, and it seemed very infantilizing, the treatment. And so we tried to come at that from a very different approach. And I think that orientation toward people's dignity and self-respect has always been really important for me. And I hope that the stories in some way kind of reflect that. One of the stories in that collection really gets at the problem of seeing people through an auditor's perspective, say, through the charting, as opposed to people who are right there in front of you. And I think that's a dilemma in the field. It's something we have to struggle with.
Of having the process be more important than the people.
Yeah, yeah. We become concerned with how everything looks on paper, because that's where the funding comes from, and that's where the supervision comes from. I remember in one of the group homes I've worked in out here, we were trained at one of our many trainings to stop using words like speak and say verbalize. It always had to have more syllables. and it seemed to me a way of maybe not intentionally, but effectively creating a division between the staff and the clients in the house, the residents in the house. We would change the way we thought about them. We'd change the way we thought about our interactions. And it's hard enough to be authentic and genuine in moments, particularly when people are sometimes very irrational. And to have to take on this other language, it seemed very counterproductive.
Just in your describing that, I would hearken it back to the language in your book, which does seem very direct, and it does not verbalize, it speaks.
Thank you.
My conversation with Dan Koshner and his latest work is Occupy and Other Love Stories from Kelly's Cove Press. Here Dan reads us one of the stories.
It's called Dilly, A Brief Study. Thinking can get you confused, says Mrs. Bandon, Dilly's mother. Take me, she says. If I think too hard about tying my shoes, I forget how. That's why you wear loafers, Mom. See, you're a clever girl. She gives Dilly's ponytail a soft tug and begins talking into the phone again. Dilly is left alone again with her thoughts and her empty hands on a partly rainy, partly sunny Saturday afternoon. At the moment, the sky outside her window is dark. She sits on the edge of her bed and rolls up one of her striped knee socks, down to her ankle and back up to her knee. Last week, Corinne, one of her classmates, had screamed, "I hate my knees. Look at them." At the time, Dilly thought, Corinne doesn't hate her knees, not if she wants us all to look at them. She doesn't believe her mother would forget how to tie her shoes, but she understands she was trying to make a point. Why do they call it a point? Maybe talking peaks like the scribble lines you see on TV when someone is on a heart monitor or a lie detector. But then a point would be like a lie, wouldn't it? She'd gotten confused when a week ago her mother had taken her to the Unitarian Church and the minister said, "Hope is lying by the side of the road." Her mother said he was being figurative. Dilly thought of figure skating, which wasn't helpful. It was just a metaphor, her mother said. Dilly's big confusion began recently, the day her fourth grade class had a substitute. He'd seemed very enthusiastic at the beginning, but by last period he looked like one of Dilly's old bedtime animals that had lost all of its stuffing in the neck. Now she thinks of her mother's expression, "My heart goes out to you." It was as if her heart had gone out to him. One of Dilly's habits was to try to be someone else for a little while. In her mind, that is. This often happened when the someone else looked sad. Why then, she didn't know, but she'd once had the idea that letting her heart go out to a sad person was good preparation for life. Because she'd heard plenty of times from her mother, especially in the months following the divorce, that life is full of hardships. The first time she'd heard that one, she thought of hardships. And she thought, if these are what life is full of, I must not have really started life yet, because I'd never seen one. Then her mother cleared up that confusion. Mother had a good laugh and shared the story with one of her friends on the phone. Dilly rolls her sock down again and up and down quickly. There's a sensation she enjoys, like her skin is waking up. But she stops because she has some thinking to do. She wants to think about the substitute, to get a handle on this thing. And she feels her eyebrows moving closer together the way people do when they say they are concentrating. The substitute had tried to teach the class about fractions and percentages. He was covering chapter 22, and Mrs. Ringwald had only gotten as far as chapter 16. If her classmates had even thought about giving him a break, staying in their seats, cutting out the crosstalk, as Mrs. Ringwald calls it, then he probably blew it by jumping so far ahead. Even the adopted Chinese girl, Kaylee, who was always respectful, started reading her history homework when the substitute brought up percentages. After recess, things only got worse. The substitute sent Nick to the principal, but Nick stood in the hall and poked his head in the doorway each time the substitute turned to face the window. The substitute had written two words on the board, metaphor and simile, and he'd asked the class a question very earnestly, with an expression that reminded Dilly of her father's face near the end of each visit, when he asked what she wanted to do the next time. Those were the times she could feel her heart going out to her father, though she couldn't often come up with a plan. The substitute had asked, "Have you seen these words before?" Barbara from the back row said no, and Corinne shook her head, and those who weren't cross-talking laughed, because Mrs. Ringwald had talked about those words plenty, a whole month ago. And then Nick from the hall called out, "Yeah, we know all about them," and there was more laughter. The substitute took off his glasses, and he made the kind of gritty smile a person makes when he's peeling off a Band-Aid, or like Dilly's father, who always takes off his glasses and smiles when he asks for a goodbye kiss. "Can anyone tell me the difference between metaphor and simile?" the substitute asked. He put his hands behind his back to feel the teacher's desk, then he leaned on it. Dilly's hand went up in the same way her heart went out. It wasn't exactly a choice. "Yes," he said, pointing to her. "When you make a simile, you always say like or as." "Very good," he said. "Can you give me an example?" Dilly wasn't at all prepared for a follow-up question. He waited. His smile started to look stiff and hard like a mask, but Dilly didn't want to say that. Her classmates, who hadn't given the substitute any attention, seemed to want to hear what Dilly had to say because the room had suddenly grown quiet. Dilly thought, "I was trying to be nice, and now look." On her first attempt, no words came out. She cleared her throat and tried again. "Hope is like lying by the side of the road," she said. The look on the substitute's face was like a complex fraction, part amusement, part puzzle, part worry. It was like a cloud shadow with patches of darkness and light passing over. She'd felt her heart going out to him, and now, surprisingly, she felt as if his heart was going out to her. "Please tell me your name," he said. That shouldn't have been a hard one. Yet suddenly she felt hot under her skin, as if someone had cupped his hands and placed them over her ears. Her face flushed. She hadn't done anything wrong, she knew. She was, in fact, the only one who'd paid attention, and probably the only one who felt concerned for this strange man's feelings. But she felt like she was in trouble. Now, sunshine blasts through her bedroom window. A slightly warped triangle lights a portion of her carpet, the bookcase, and the corner of the bed where she sits. She pulls up her sock and pulls it down again, and again and again and again. Each time she pulls it down, the barely visible hairs on her shins stand up. The hairs are not pretty to Dilly, nor ugly either. People are mammals. They have hair all over their bodies. That's just how it is. But these hairs seem to be protesting, to be saying, "What in the heck is going on here?" If they could really speak, they would say, "We were fine until you came along." And isn't that part of what Dilly had been feeling before she'd cleared her throat and said to the substitute, "My name is Corinne." Of course, Corinne had to announce, "No, my name is Corinne." And then Nick, peeking from the hall, hollered out the same. The man had been smiling his puzzled smile until her classmates burst out in hoots and laughter. The smile then turned to something else, a frozen look. A possum on the roadside look. Then the man turned to face the board. She hadn't meant to hurt him. All she wanted was for him to turn and face the board.
Dan Koshner reading from Occupy and Other Love Stories. I think we have time for another song from Carl Handel and Eddie Meissy from their album Wanted, The Songs of Paul Handel. This is I Tried to Find You.
I found the note you left this morning on the empty pillow next to me. This time I realize you weren't bluffing when you said that you were gonna leave. I tried to find you at the station. I got there too late and you were gone. I wish I would have come to you and told you. I'm sorry, but my pride held out too long.
You've been listening to A Novel Idea. I'm Suzanne Lang, and we've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Jesse Fankishin. You can listen to our podcast at krcb.org and subscribe and listen through iTunes or any way you want to listen. A Novel Idea is a production of Lit Radio and KRCB Public Media. Thanks for listening.
Tried to find you at the station. I got there too late and you were gone. I wish I would have come to you and told you. Well, I'm sorry, my pride held out too long. Yes, I'm sorry, my pride held out too long.
We're KRCB, we're the New 91, and we are supported by listeners like you.